Hello, welcome everybody. I would say this would be an intimate conversation, but you're so far away. You're all very fortunate to be at this panel right now with this group of amazing women. The way that this is going to go is that first I'm going to introduce myself. My name is Allison Castell, and I'm an instructor of Peace, Conflict, and Security Studies here at CU Boulder. And my own research is on how communities in Colombia are responding to the peace processes. And I do actually have a bit of a focus on gender, so I'd be happy to and delighted to contribute to this conversation. So without further ado, I would like to first introduce, and I'm not going to go through and read each of their bios because you're welcome to do that on your own, but Susie Snyder, our first panelist, coordinates the global Don't Bank on the Bomb research and campaign as part of her job as the Nuclear Disarmament Program Manager in PAX in the Netherlands. What isn't in the bio is that Susie has a coffee mug with a picture of herself holding the Nobel Peace Prize. Yes, which she earned as part of the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. Wow. Second, we'll be hearing from Margot Squire, who is a career diplomat for 30 years with the U.S. Most notably, she is a third-generation U.S. diplomat, which is quite unheard of. And she has served in Munich, Moscow, Melbourne, Baku, Ankara, and in Washington, D.C., and currently lives in Wisconsin, where after experiencing her firsthand observation of elections overseas, has decided that she wants to be engaged in election processes in her own county. And so, notably, she was also part of the Wisconsin recount, which was very famous. So we're excited to hear from Margot. And Heather Hurlburt directs the New Models of Policy Change Initiative at New America's Political Reform Program. Heather, when she was in college, this is the part that's not in the bio, had a male friend explain to her or tell her that women don't like arms control. So guess what Heather's first job was out of college? Arms control. So we're really excited to hear from all of you, and please welcome our panelists, and Susie, feel free to start us off.
Thanks, everybody. It's awesome to be here. I'm loving Boulder. It's the first time I've ever actually hung out in this city. I've only driven through once before, and wow. That's quite nice. I understand why there's been a bit of a population explosion. So I get that. It's pretty neat. A bit dry, but pretty neat. It's really nice to be here. I used to work with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And we had one of our kind of key women from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom was a professor here at University of Colorado, Elise Boulding. So Elise Boulding from Boulder is how I always used to remember it, which is, you know, just my own mnemonic, letting you in on my secret. So it's great to be here, and it's really excited, especially to talk about this issue of women waging peace and to be amongst incredible women. And I've met, at this conference, I've sought out intentionally and met some of the most incredible women, and I'm grateful for the great lessons that they've given me, the amazing senses of humor, and just general fun. So, the first question I always ask myself on these things is, you know, are we talking about this because women are inherently more peaceful? And no. I also answer it really easy. Just because you don't have a penis does not make you more of a peaceful person. Where we are socialized to negotiate and to get what we want through negotiations. And that's why we're understood to be more peaceful sometimes, because that's what society demands of us. We're not always able to physically dominate and get what we want that way. And that's, you know, except for me, I'm 6'2", I'm a giant, you know, I'm sitting down right now. But so it's part of the socialization. So there's this assumption that's often made about women being more peaceful. And I just, for me, and I'll speak for myself, I think that's not true. However, I do think there is something to be said for feminist peace agendas. And I ascribe to feminist peace agendas. Those that look to ensure the participation of women in discussions and negotiations, the participation of men in discussions and negotiations, the participation of all genders in those discussions. That, to me, that's part of what feminism is everyone is at the table. And the prevention, using, you know, discussion to prevent conflict. So as we wage peace, the tools to do that, we need to prevent conflict as much as we can, and we need to protect the most vulnerable in society to do so. So someone pointed out to me, it was 18 years ago? I felt a little old. 18 years ago, the UN Security Council adopted the first resolution it had ever adopted on women, peace, and security, and it's Security Council Resolution 1325. And those numbers, 1325, 1325, this is a Security Council resolution, like a kind of a boring text, Security Council resolution that has a global constituency. In 75 countries, there are national action plans to make sure that this Security Council resolution, this idea of participation, protection, and prevention is brought into all aspects of that country's operations on security issues. And in some countries, the 1325 National Action Plan is great, but not in all of them. And it's something to work on. But there's a global constituency working on this. And I think that's really important that global constituency be broad. Because none of these discussions, there should be no discussion about us without us. And I think that's really important. And the participation angle is something for me that's very high on my personal agenda, because I spend my days thinking about, talking about, unfortunately dreaming about nuclear weapons. Last summer, 122 governments agreed to adopt a text of a treaty to make nuclear weapons illegal, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Through the power of women and men working together, that treaty text includes specific language that recognizes the disproportionate impact of nuclear weapons on women and girls. This is really important. As a woman who has worked on nuclear weapons, this is really important for me that that is recognized and enshrined in a global agreement, because my body, just because I was born female, my body has been affected differently because of the production, the testing, the existence of nuclear weapons. And now there is a global text that recognizes that. And so I have a little bit more, I feel a little bit stronger, a little bit more empowered to talk about it. Well, I didn't need that much encouragement, I'll be honest. But it's nice to have a little bit of recognition of that as well. And I'll be honest, it was not solely women that got this language in that text. And it never is. It is a partnership. We bring different things to the table when we talk. And that's why the participation angle is so important. That's why all must be represented. And those who are socialized to get what they want through discussion, diplomacy, win-win solutions, that deserves every bit as much respect as those who stand up or might be a little bit bigger, or their stick might be a little bit thicker. Anyway, I think I'll leave it there. And again, thanks everybody for coming out here this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Susie. For many of us here, and it's interesting to see that we've all worked in, you know, arms control, nuclear issues, women waging peace is personal. In my own case as a diplomat, I think about women who worked in diplomacy over the years and who have been crucial for peace. So I'm going to draw on my background and on women in diplomacy. A lot of these same things are true obviously for men, and for women from all diplomats from all countries, certainly those that I met. A couple of weeks ago, I started looking at a website of oral histories of U.S. diplomats, and it's an amazing rabbit hole to go into to hear these stories of these people. And so I'm going to share some of the stories. But first, I just want to say that diplomacy is by nature, it's quiet, it's slow, it's plodding. It's about listening and building consensus and compromise, working with people in countries that are friends and foes, to get things important accomplished, consensus for a new arms control agreement, advocating for human rights, figures that are in prison, or human rights in general, building a development project. Women are in all of our missions around the world over some 200 places, from London to Lesotho, from Kabul to Khartoum. And I was privileged to work with some really great women. For example, Catherine Koob, who I met in the 90s in Melbourne, Australia, who had been taken hostage in Tehran in 1979, where she headed the Iranian-American Cultural Center. It was a little bit outside of the embassy. And so when the students took over the embassy, she continued working and, in fact, became the communication center with Washington and the rest of the world. And she stayed there, went home that night, and came back the next day, even though the German Cultural Center next door offered to give her shelter. And the two men that replaced her overnight ended up going to the Canadians and were rescued through the story that's Argo. But she went back to work the next day. And she and the students picked her up. So she was one of two women. Most of the women were released. She was one of two women who stayed for the full 444 days because she was a foreign service officer, not a secretary, and the Iranians said they thought she could be a spy. So these two. And she said she went back because she had a job to do, and she wanted to keep lines of communication open with the Iranian people. Other women have served through coups, embassy bombings, stayed to evacuate Americans from war zones, Mogadishu to Georgia. I think of Prudence Bushnell, who was our ambassador to Kenya when the embassy in 1998 was bombed simultaneously with our embassy in Tanzania. And later, they heard at the trial of the Al-Qaeda bombers that they had specifically targeted her embassy because she was a woman and they figured it would get more attention. And more about Prudence Bushnell. She was an African specialist, and she tried to stop the killing in Rwanda. But she was blocked by others, mostly men in senior positions, at the State Department, Department of Defense, the White House, and Congress, and in Rwanda itself, who would not help her. She turned to broadcasting on radio into Rwanda. Any channel that would give me an interview to implore the government to stop the bloodshed. She was not successful. But this made her work harder a number of years later when she recognized the terrible toll that AIDS was taking in Africa. And this time she was able to mobilize support from within the U.S. government to address this. But she attributed this to the frustration and inability to get anything done the first time around with Rwanda. I think of my friend Stephanie Miley, who was the State Department head of do you know Stephanie?
Stephanie Miley, I love her.
Yeah, a provincial reconstruction team in Iraq, in the provinces. As a woman, she arrived at her post and was an outcast to both the military leaders, American military leaders, and Afghan leadership in the area. But she won them over through her smarts, her determination, and her people skills. And she told me about going to a meeting with an Iraqi local leader. And as the military commanders were starting to talk about the agenda, she interrupted. She remembered that the Afghan leader had just recently lost a loved one to the war. And so her first words were to offer condolences. And it sounds like a little thing, but this compassion then helped her to build a relationship with this leader that lasted through her time there. My last job at the State Department was in weapons of mass destruction, non-proliferation. It was before the ICON movement really gathered steam. And I thought that I was coming to an area that would be dominated by men. So I was amazed that the leading female negotiator, our top diplomat, was Rose Gademiller. She is now the number two at NATO, not the American number two, the Deputy Secretary General of NATO. But at state, she conducted the arms control negotiations, you know, at the highest level. She had a wonderful appreciation for the personal level, reaching people. And I think of the creative ways that she brought us to using social media to engage minds outside of government, like crowdsourcing to find new ways for citizens on the ground to verify weapons systems. Think about that through apps and other ways to try to get people, you know, in their own countries to not, you know, not just the government officials and the military. And we had other people at top levels at state. Susan Burke, who was our lead negotiator for the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Ambassador Laura Kennedy at UN Vienna at the Conference on Disarmament. And also Ambassador Laura Holgate at the NSC. And top women at DOD and DOE. And now look at the women around me who have worked on nonproliferation. So the last person I wanted to mention was Anne Smettinghoff, a 25-year-old killed by a bomb in Afghanistan, on her way to deliver school books to children at the opening of a new school in Helmand Province. And in her eulogy, Secretary Kerry said she represented her country by being warm and helpful and compassionate. So thank you for letting me make this brazen plug for women working for peace through diplomacy. I believe we need all the forces we can get, diplomats, NGOs, people in the think tank and academic world, people on the ground in these countries. But heavens knows the State Department right now needs all of our support, and we need to keep diplomacy high on our agenda while meanwhile we're militarizing our foreign policy. Thank you.
I just have to say, to start, I have these wonderful memories of Stephanie Miley going all over the world with white bread sandwiches to eat with her. And so if you have ever thought that you are not intrepid enough to go out and see the world, Stephanie, I mean, as you've just heard, ran a provincial reconstruction team in Afghanistan, which is not something I would be brave enough to do. And so she had this thing about what she ate, but man, she went out and went everywhere anyway. And the other point I want to make to start is that, in fact, women have been integral in the U.S. government arms control enterprise since the 70s. And I have this theory, which I've never quite figured out either how to test or, frankly, how to get the money to spend the time to test it. But the fact that arms control sort of appears as a thing in American diplomacy, in the American government, right about the time that married women are allowed to join the Foreign Service and that the women's movement happens and that women are allowed into our most elite academic institutions. I know some places like the University of Colorado were enlightened about admitting women for a lot longer than some elite institutions back east that shall go unnamed, including the one I went to. But I've always thought that the arms control and disarmament enterprise benefited enormously from coming to prominence in American public life at the same moment that there were all these women sort of looking for a place that they can make a difference. I want to go back to something Susie said, which may be controversial here, but which I entirely agree with. I've been struggling personally since my undergraduate days because I share the view that women are not inherently more peaceful. I got to college when what was still very big was difference feminism, and I was like, but I like to argue, and I'm good at arguments, and I usually win them. So, like, does that make me a bad woman? Uh-oh. So, having said that, there are some things that we actually do know really well through very solid social science. And I wanna run through what those things are. So number one, we know that diverse teams produce stronger outcomes. And that's true for women. It's also true for other kinds of diversity. Diverse teams check each other's biases. Diverse teams don't allow huge fallacies to go unaddressed. Diverse teams do what we call red teaming better. So if you want a stronger outcome, you really need a team where everybody does not all look the same and have all the same background. And that's just incontrovertible across sectors. There's really no debate about that anymore. Second, as a result of UN Resolution 1325, there grew up slowly but steadily an attempt to look with social science about what it matters when women are included or excluded from peace processes. And there, again, the research hasn't come as thickly or fast as one might wish, but we have pretty strong evidence that when you include women in peace delegations, both as diplomats and negotiators and by thinking about women's groups as part of the civil society that you want to have at the table in trying to bind up the wounds of a society and end a conflict, either of those approaches gets you a peace agreement that's more likely to endure. And there are numbers for that. Again, that is not as widely known as it should be, but it's just not controversial. You can't argue it away. The third thing about women in peace, which is now quite solidly established through social science, is what is the single best predictor of whether a society will be in conflict either internally or with its neighbors? It's not income, it's not ethnic diversity, it's the amount of violence against women. How a country treats its women is the single best predictor of whether it will be at peace or not. Now, you might think to yourself, well, that's really interesting. And so obviously, if we have social science that says these things, we must have an incredibly flourishing industry in academia, in think tanks, and in government of people trying to figure out how to put those insights into policy. But you would be sadly wrong. On a panel the other day, I told a story that I heard from an undergraduate here who asked to do an independent study on gender and international relations and was told by her professor that he was uncomfortable with the idea that gender had anything to do with international relations. And I said, I'd like to know the professor's name so that I can send him a bibliography and then I can go punch him.
Wait, peace.
Peace, right, yeah, so I won't punch anybody.
Waging peace.
Yes, yes. But in fairness to this individual, whoever he may have been, he's in a lot of really good company. And for the last couple of years, I've been running a research program at New America that has been trying to document first in government and then in academia, because after all, it is academia where we train our next generation of diplomats, of military leaders, of think tank leaders, of NGO leaders, and also where we tell them what's important and what's not. You know, what you take in grad school really tells you what's inside the canon and what is outside the canon. And I thought, you know, I'm a hard-bitten practitioner. I worked in the White House and the State Department and on Capitol Hill. And, like, I know that, like, all these women working on this stuff, like, that hasn't penetrated as much as they think it has. And I was shocked at how little it has penetrated. And I was just flipping back through the report we put out at New America. And among the dismissive comments, one of them was, oh, Women, Peace, and Security, which, of course, is the title of a UN Security Council resolution. That sounds like a slogan for Democrats. Or that sounds like you're trying to say something inherent about women, and I don't like that. Or that sounds like cultural imperialism that you want Americans to impose on foreign cultures. Or, well, in my 40 years, and this is an actual honest-to-God quote by a senior policymaker, in my 40 years in Washington, I've never experienced a problem with gender. So that was a steeper hill to climb than I was anticipating. So then, as I said, we went out and surveyed professors, and then we surveyed students. And what you find talking to professors is, again, real sort of lack of knowledge of this topic, of the basic social science data I ran through with you a minute ago, and there are some hilarious anecdotes here, like Ann Tickner, who's one of the great founding mothers of feminist international relations, recalls being told by a male colleague in one of her departments that he didn't teach her books because they were too hard. And I gotta say, I've never in my life told a colleague I couldn't do something because it was too hard, because I'd be laughed out of the room if I did that. There's sort of a piece of good news is actually the Fletcher School at Tufts instituted the dean, who was a retired four-star admiral and had seen firsthand how much more effective his own work was if he was getting women to fully participate in it, instituted a program where he said, if you will incorporate gender into your syllabus, I will give you an extra paid TA. So I will give you a teaching assistant who knows gender and gender analysis and the literature that we're talking about for free if you will use that TA to incorporate the material into your classes. And the reason this is important, I'll say as my last point, is that then we surveyed students. And students were really interesting because, as so often, they were sort of surprising their elders, and they were showing up in the classroom with a whole bunch of ideas, shocking ideas about women and peace and gender and conflict. But they weren't getting, surprise, surprise, they weren't getting these ideas from academic literature. They weren't getting ideas from, you know, again, the social science that I've just referred to. They were getting them from popular culture. And so then we said to students, okay, well, what would make you learn the academic literature? What would make you interested in it? And the most popular response we got was the great reply of students everywhere in all times, if it's going to be on the test. So the way in the American, and I should say, the Canadians are way ahead of this on this. A number of European countries are way ahead of us, some others. But the way it's going to happen here is that these ideas that we've all been talking about become part of the standard sort of set of expectations. Like when I went to college during the Cold War, and you couldn't be an international relations scholar if you didn't know a little something about nuclear weapons. Now, we've seen, unfortunately, in the last year and a half, that there are a hell of a lot of people who think they can be policymakers without knowing anything about nuclear weapons or understanding how deterrence works. So clearly those days are over and gone. But my idea is that we want to be working toward a future where you can't be an international relations practitioner if you don't have some idea about how different genders experience policy. And I want to finish by giving one or two examples of sort of how that actually works in practice. And one of them is in post-conflict demobilization. And it turns out all over the world, really well-meaning governments and humanitarian organizations have this incredibly bad habit of assuming that there are only male combatants. And there are a number of documented cases where really well-meaning organizations went in with demobilization programs, but they had nothing. So they had job training for men. They had sort of how to reintegrate into your communities, how to come to terms with what you've done. But they had nothing for women, and so they just sent the women back to the villages. And that didn't go very well. And so in at least one case, you actually had, and again, this goes counter to many, many stereotypes that we have about women, the recidivist forces that refused to accept the peace agreement were women who went back to their villages, found they had nothing, found they weren't accepted, there were no jobs, no training for them. So they picked up weapons and went back into the bush. Fail. There's another great example from countering violent extremism where the first people to pick up on the movement of ISIS to North Africa were analysts who noticed ISIS women moving to North Africa. And those analysts said to themselves, what we know about ISIS is they try to reward fighters by giving them wives and setting up a whole structure around them. And so if we see women moving, that has to be important because it means permanence and family structure. And they didn't say, oh, those are just the women, they're not important. They said, oh, those women, that movement of women teaches us something about what the organization as a whole is doing. And if I have one more second, because sometimes we do think that all of this is just about women, There's really interesting research emerging that another really big driver of extremist movements is high bride prices, which is to say when young men don't have the ability to get into the marriage market in their society and attain the dignity and respect that come from being able to start a family, they are much more likely to either look for other purposes in their life or be just driven to extreme means to get the money. And an anecdote that I'll just close with is if folks remember the horrific bombings in India in late 2008, the sole bomber who was taken alive was a young man from a village in Pakistan, and he told his interrogators that he had never wanted to be a terrorist. He had never wanted to join an extremist group, but no one in his family could afford a wife. And his father said to him, if you go to this extremist group, they will pay the bride price not just for you, but for your brothers. So if we were thinking about a healthy masculinity for that man and his brothers, what would we have been doing that might have discouraged him and many others from joining an extremist group? And I'll leave it there.
So first of all, thank you so much for those enlightening comments. And if I might just take a couple of minutes to reflect a little bit and on the last thing that you said, Heather, which is really important in the whole gender and conflict studies, canon, if you will, is a push for understanding masculine identities within that, because if we are talking about patriarchy and how women are ascended and socialized within that, men are also having that same experience. So something that we need to draw attention to. And I'd like to, just for one second, if we're thinking about feminism, as you brought up, Susie, and feminist perspectives, and if we think about conflict as the production of marginalization through voices that cannot be heard as well in the national discourse or narrative landscape, the feminist standpoint theory positions women as not only necessary, but the best location for starting to understand the basis of conflict and how to wage peace because of their particular understandings of what it feels like to be marginalized and to understand the experiences of other marginalized populations. So feminist standpoint theory would argue that this is the very point where we should be locating ourselves and recognizing not only those feminine identities, but also the masculine as well within that. And in thinking about that when we're talking about participation, which I think is a very critical point to be understanding in the realm of peace building, because participation has become a kind of buzzword, you know, an important central part of how people are gauging whether or not peace is being leveraged enough by women, right? And so there's this adage, I'm sure many of you have heard the add women and stir metaphor, which means that if you invite women to the party, then there is gender equality. But this needs to be interrogated a little bit further as to what does participation actually mean? Because if you're working for peace in societies where women are historically marginalized and do not have safe entry with their voices, and they show up to a meeting that is historically dominated by men, who's to say that they're going to speak up? And so I can think of times when I was in Colombia where we went into rural villages to speak with people about their experiences in the peace process, and being very elated as people told us, oh, you're going to be so excited. There's going to be so many women there, and we're going to have this great conversation. We're going to understand how the women feel about this, and, you know, welcome, welcome. And we sit around in a circle, and the women sit in the margins of the circle, kind of in the back with their kids, while men stand up and sing songs and proclaim their experiences and go around in a circle, and then once they're finished, look over and say, hey, what about the women? Do you guys have anything you want to say? Silence. So I think of this sometimes when I think about how participation is articulated in some of the platforms and some of the biggest agencies that use this just add women and stir metaphor, which is if women are there, then participation is happening. And I think it's something that really needs to be taken deeply into consideration. And then the secondary part of that, which I found very interesting too, with the gentleman, I just made an assumption that it was a man who said that he'd never experienced anything negative about gender.
Okay.
is that when you're at a meeting, if you're doing peace building, who's setting the agenda? Right? Who's doing the agenda setting? Because if the agenda is being set by people who are dominant, then it is very possible that the concerns of the people who are most vulnerable and most affected by conflict are not going to have their agenda items accounted for. So there's these very kind of nuanced particularities that take place in the practice of some of these things that really, they happen differently depending on the context, and that's what's so important, even about something like the 1325 that came into being, which is unprecedented and set up the stage for conversations to happen that weren't able to happen before. But not everybody was able to have the is still able to have those conversations. So you can set up your plaque 1325. We're gonna start implementing programs. But if you're in societies where these gender norms and male dominance and domestic violence and post conflict situations are occurring, there's challenges that we might not guess or be able to understand without going into the context. And I don't want to take up too much time talking about it, but we did have a small research project in Indonesia where we were trying to understand why women weren't coming to the spaces that were created in order for them to be able to articulate their grievances. And so we knocked on their doors, went to their homes and asked them, and they told us they were scared. So these are some things that help us look at the interplay that we absolutely need these foregrounded laws and platforms for conversations to start to happen. And then when we're actually in the midst of the doing, we have to pay attention to the nuances on the ground and how actual gender dynamics are playing out. And it is both personal and political, right? So the final thing I just wanted to talk about is Colombia for 1 second, based on Heather's last comment about combatants. Because if people understand that as an example where the FARC, which has been in signed an historic peace agreement with the Colombian government, the combatants that are they're disarming themselves, a third of the combatants in the FARC are women. So this is something that really we need to call attention to it. So wonderful. And those are the remarks that I wanted to make. And I invite if you would like to have a chance with each other to make some comments and responses, I'll open the floor for that. And then I will look through some of these questions that we can take from the audience.
One thought that I had was working for the State Department, I was privileged to have 3 women secretaries of state, which is a pretty amazing thing. And they all brought special qualities. They were very different, but they brought special qualities. And one of the things in the last administration under Hillary Clinton was they instituted this sort of review of practices and policies, basically drawing from the Defense Department. It was called the Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review, QDDR, and it had a lot of recommendations, and one of the recommendations was to incorporate gender throughout foreign policy and development. And, you know, I think there were a lot of people who thought, well, what the hell does that mean? But there were people that in parts of the State Department that used that creatively and to look at how they could, you know, push the gender issues and human rights, like LGBT rights in parts of the world where people are killed because of their gender, in development. I mean, the obvious case that people always use is the building of a well. You know, you go to the village elders and you say, we want to you know, help you with your water situation so that people don't have to carry the water for so long. We're going to build a well. And they say, oh, yes, yes, this is where you need to build it, and this is how you have to build it. Well, if you don't incorporate women, it still can be miles away. And guess who gets the water? It's the women. And, oh, and by the way, the pump is too high for them to use, and it's not, so they don't end up using it. So, you know, there are practical reasons also to get women involved from the ground up.
It's really funny because you use the well analogy, and I always used to use the bridge analogy, you know, and you're building a bridge from point A to point B, and the bridge is wide enough to take an ox cart, but fails to have a pedestrian pathway. And it's just those, it's those little things that make a tremendous difference. I'm a big fan of gender analysis, and within my own organization in POX, we're constantly looking at how to do this better. We work with partners in 17 conflict affected areas, and it's an issue for us. How do we, you know, as civil society, as non-governmental organization, working with civil society members, how do we, in conflict countries, how do we bring that gender analysis to the table? And how do we bring the understanding of the need for it to the table? And it's not add women and stir, but I will say this, bringing women to the meetings makes a huge difference. So it's not, like, that's not the end of the intervention. But in some instances, it is a significant and extremely useful first step. And if there are no women there, then the conversation is just not good enough. And that's something that can be very difficult. We also work with a lot of religious leaders. And so in conflict-affected countries, working with religious leaders, there's a lot of patriarchy tied up in religion. I'm sure folks here, I don't have to go into the depth of that. And it's been a really difficult thing to bring about, especially, you know, we're connected to the Catholic peace movement. It's challenging for us internally to figure out how to do this well, and not just about wells, right? And the one thing that we're learning is that every intervention that we are engaged in, we have to go back and assess, and we go back and we ask, did it work? Did it not work? What were our assumptions? And questioning those assumptions has made a huge difference. And that's something that I'm very proud of my colleagues that are willing to continually challenge partners that we've had for decades to question their own assumptions and to do it in not the best of conditions. And it's really difficult when you're in Eastern Ukraine and you're documenting the impact of explosive weapons and to talk about the gendered impact of explosive weapons in Eastern Ukraine. You know, it's very difficult when you're racing to get your colleagues out of Syria to make sure that they, you know, to try to get them out so that their kids have parents to start to bring this conversation into the discussion. And yet it's necessary, and we're trying very hard to do so. But I'll tell you, you know, we also have to give ourselves a little bit of a break if we're not doing it really well every single time. And I want to build that into the conversation as well. As long as we keep moving forward and keep working on it, we can't assume perfection at every step of the way.
Yeah, I'll pick up on that a bit because there were over the last 8 or 10 years there were quite a few really interesting efforts both within the U.S. government and in the humanitarian and NGO sector saying, okay, well, so now you're in Iraq and Afghanistan. So what can we do there to make gender analysis to part of how the work is done to lift up women's voices in peace and post-conflict reconstruction processes? And I recently had the opportunity to co-chair a couple of working groups trying to look at lessons learned from those two experiences, frankly, as there's not just a diminishment of attention to women, but a diminishment of attention to the civilian side, as Margot referred to, of those issues all together. And so you're left now with the kind of odd situation that in some cases you're trying to pitch these ideas to the military, which is not necessarily always the natural home for them because, as I said on other panels, the military's job is to break things and hurt people. But one of the cross-cutting lessons that folks who had worked on the ground in both Iraq and Afghanistan found was, in fact, exactly that local women wanted more of a voice in religious matters and wanted to figure out how, wanted to address the challenge of bringing women's voices into religion, and actually were sort of, you know, this is not something that foreigners should be taking the lead on, but that there were in both societies women who wanted to be taking the lead and wanted to be doing more. So I think that's just a really interesting, again, that if you go to a society and you are just willing to listen, women are already doing this work themselves. One just last little tiny point, and I really, as I said, I never liked difference feminism. I really wrestled with I still don't. It makes me very uncomfortable to say this, but when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, women were at the table for peace talks in Afghanistan, and women were at the table for peace talks in Syria. And I am very chagrined to say that from the moment Hillary Clinton stopped being Secretary of State, it became a never-ending battle in the U.S. government to get the U.S. government to put its oomph behind women getting to the table in those two peace processes.
Thank you for sharing all of those insights. And so we have I have a cluster of questions here that's going to get a little bit more personal about your experiences kind of advancing in your career. So I'm just going to read them and whatever speaks to you to speak to. What do you bring to the table as female leaders, and what did you need to let go of in order to fully step into your power as a female leader living in a patriarchal society? And how exactly did you prove yourselves in your field? Being smart and hardworking is often overlooked, especially with women of color. How do we navigate that? And what is the most prominent form of discrimination you faced as a woman in your career? So any one of those, I feel, would be wonderful to treat.
So I think one of the things that I found personally hard was to say no. And I learned that you have to say no, and in fact, people appreciate it when you say no. So I think also as you know, from my childhood as a girl, I was taught, you know, to acquiesce, be gentle, be. So I think that was one thing, that it's important to be able to say no, and no is actually often the most charitable thing. You know, if someone's applying for a job, call them and tell them why they didn't get the job, and really sorry that I didn't get you, because so many times people would tell me, nobody's ever called me before. You know, now I can get on with my life. Speaking up, you know, the question of persisting, Nancy Pelosi is at lunch and she's the only woman of the congressional leaders and everyone's talking over her, and three times she tries to say something and finally she says, what does it take for a woman to be heard? And it's that's something that's absolutely I've seen throughout my career, is that often you are not heard or you're ignored, or the male who then after you says, you know, oh, I think blah blah blah, and he's just repeated what you said, but somehow it's, yeah. And I told Heather this story before, but I thought it was a wonderful one. And it's someone in one of the women in the Obama NSC, National Security Council. And the National Security Council is a very testosterone-filled place anyway. I think it's really, it would be a hard place to work in. But they found that because, and also because these are go-getters, people who are the best of the best. And so the males were just, you know, jumping in and saying, you know, and doing things and ignoring the women and doing what I just said. So they had this policy where the women banded together, and they said, when a woman brings up an issue, support her, you know, your fellow sister. And oh, you know, that was an interesting thing that you just brought up, Susie. Could you talk about that a little bit further? Ignore the person who's just tried to speak in. Or, I think Susie just a little while ago said something that sounded just like that. And you know what? And I like that. And I think that's something that we can incorporate, not just for women, but for, you know, all of the voices that we don't hear. I'm an introvert, and I tend to sit back and not say things very much. So, and the conversation goes on. And so, you know, support those people. So that's my two cents.
I love that one. I've heard that story. I do that constantly. I think it's so important, especially if you know that it's somebody who's a little bit, who's a little quiet, who doesn't speak in the meeting very often, who you see, and then, you know, because there's such brilliance that it's quiet in the back of the room, and no matter who it is and what level they are, it's about the idea. Mm-hmm. It's not about who, but you have to elevate the idea. And if you don't give credit to people who come with that idea, they're not going to get ahead in their career, and we're going to lose out on their ideas. And I don't want to do that. I need smart people around me. You know, I think it's the only way I've gotten ahead. And that's the thing. I surround myself with really smart people. Yeah, you know, if you're not learning something from the people around you, then switch to another table. You know, go sit somewhere else. Talk to other folks. Challenge yourself. Quote people who you find inspiring and give them credit for it. You know, I think that's really nice when and where you can do that. And people don't have to know who they are. You know, if you're quoting somebody, especially if you're kind of public speaking, you're quoting somebody and somebody will Google it. And then maybe they'll get, you know, somebody will buy a book or something. I'm a big fan of, and this was said on a panel I just went to and listened in on, which is the Don't Be Bossy, Be the Boss panel. Someone said, it was Charlie, whose last name I forgot. Charlie said, delegate, learn how to delegate. Whew, learn how to do it. And this builds off of Margaret just said about saying no. Learn how to delegate. It's so hard. I'll just do it. 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 Nah, just delegate. That also gives more people more opportunities to be amazing. And then give them credit for being amazing. And there's two last thoughts I have on this. One is wear bright colors. Seriously, and this I learned from Patricia Lewis. She's the director of security policy at Chatham House, and she is amazing and brilliant and one of my role models in the world. And she came to me when I was kind of younger and starting in my career, and she said, you don't have to wear a black suit every day. You know, it's really, you don't have to switch between black and gray and navy blue. It's okay to wear color. And yeah, you're a woman. It's all right. You know, fluff the plumage a bit. And then I find myself in these photographs of, you know, conferences where I'm the only, there's everybody in the dark suit, dark suit, dark suit, dark suit. Me wearing like bright green or bright blue. I don't look good in red. I've learned. I still do it sometimes. And the very last thing, I actually interrupt. And I interrupt people and I don't apologize for interrupting people until afterwards. I say, oh, sorry I interrupted you then. But I, if somebody's saying something that I think is horrifying, I do interrupt. And this is why I'm on the NGO side. I'm okay with that. It's, you know, it's something that does not endear me to my older male colleagues. But it's about the idea. So at the end of the day, let's get the good ideas forward.
I love the way that two of those questions, at least for me, are kind of in tension with each other, because I don't know about the three of you, but for most of my career, I still, at some level, felt like I needed to prove myself every damn day, and that I walked into the State Department or the White House or the interview just feeling like I had to prove myself all over again every day. And in some ways, I think that served me very well. And in other ways, I think it was, and it certainly is now, a waste of energy that could be better used on other things. So, you know, for me at this point in my life, the challenge is kind of just reminding myself that maybe, just maybe today, I don't need to prove myself. And if you aren't willing to treat me like I'm at the point in my career I am, that's probably going to reflect badly on you, and I should just relax about that. I do want to take on, because I think it's important for us to reinforce this, I don't know if either of you wants to loop back and mention bad experiences. I repeatedly found out I was being paid 5 figures less than my male colleagues, and sometimes I was able to fix that, and sometimes I wasn't. I had actually only one pretty mild instance of out-and-out harassment, but I had a long, really unpleasant period of belittlement. And eventually in that job, I finally from somewhere crawled out of the pit of despair I was in and convinced a male colleague to submit one of my speech drafts with his name on it. And our boss thought it was brilliant. And I thought, oh, this is great. My problems are all solved now. And we're going to go in and I'm going to be like, no, I actually wrote this. See how good I am? And they laughed. They thought it was funny. All the guys in the office thought it was funny. But I had proved to myself that I was as good as my colleague, and that helped me get through the experience. I also want to say, just because I've never said this in public before, I was told I couldn't work in the White House because I have a special needs child. So that's the worst thing that happened to me. But actually, you know what? I have this great career, and I have this wonderful child that I have a wonderful relationship with. So sometimes the worst thing that happens to you is actually not that bad.
I stopped wearing glitter nail polish when I moved to D.C. and had to go to the State Department.
Can I tell a fingernail story?
I wish I didn't stop. But it was hard. It was so weird.
Yeah. So Hillary Clinton goes to Burma the first time. Do you know this story? So the first time that Secretary of State has gone for a long time because it was a terrible, you know, terrible country. And so this is a really big deal. And the U.S. is acknowledging, of course, this is way before now and the terrible things that have been happening with the Rohingya. And so she goes, and this is a really good news story. And one of the things they do is they take her to a temple, and she takes off her shoes, and she has purple toenails. And that becomes the story. Oh, the Secretary of State has purple toenails. Not the good news about Burma.
I'm a little bit torn on which question to ask next. I'll ask this one. It's from a student who wants to know about the tension, because we're talking so much about supporting sisterhood in a meeting, and basically the student is asking, what if the woman is saying something that you think is...
I interrupt.
Dumb.
No, seriously. Yeah. Like, no, if I'm sorry, and I do go up to people and apologize afterwards. But again, it's about the idea,
right?
You want to promote good ideas, and you want to, you know, men get lifted up a lot with the good ideas that they have, and they get the recognition a lot, in my experience. And women get that a bit less, so let's try to balance that out.
But there's a caveat.
Exactly.
There's a caveat. Yeah.
Okay. It's got to be good ideas.
Right. As I think everybody knows, I'm liberal. And I have huge admiration for the conservative women I know who hold jobs and work in the field that I do. And so I will do things on Twitter like, hey, for a conservative perspective on this issue, you should really check out Cori Shaki or Mackenzie Eaglin, who are two women who you should check out, by the way. So I am trying to lift them up as women, even as I would fight like hell against some of their ideas. And I find that not always, but in general, they would do the same.
And one other thing, wine. Just afterwards. No, some of the arguments that I have with people in this field, like, you know, I know some women who believe that nuclear deterrence is the best thing that ever happened since sliced bread and even before that. And we can still drink a glass of wine together. And we are almost fundamentally opposite in our belief, but we still work with each other. We talk to each other. We have a glass of wine or soda, whatever it is that you, I don't care what you drink. And get to know each other as human beings and recognize the humanity in one another. And I find that is to be the case with a lot. It's a lot easier for me to reach out to other women working and with different perspectives than it is for me to reach out to men to just chat about the different perspectives that we have. And that's something that I've noticed lately, and I'm trying to be better at. I'm trying to talk to more men about the differences. They make it hard sometimes, but I'm trying. But no, but, you know, so wine.
Once again, a little divided on where I should go with this, but someone has asked the question about the current gun control issue in the United States in light of the current protests that have been going on with the high school students, and if you have any thoughts about that in relationship to your own work or more generally?
Start. You know, more power to them. It's a fantastic civil grassroots, clearly, you know, people picking up a really important issue that divides this country. And, you know, I worked in helping development throughout the former Soviet Union of just type, you know, trying to support groups like this that would pick, you know, whether it was an environmental topic or whether it was, arms control in their own countries. So, I think this is great, and I think it should be supported. I mean, one of the really smart things that they've done is not to, you know, they themselves have not identified it with either the Democratic or the Republican Party. And to the extent that that can continue, I think that's really good. You know, I worked on, in my last job, on the Arms Trade Treaty, which is an international treaty that makes each country, you know, before you sell arms, you know, evaluate who you're selling arms to overseas so that it doesn't go to terrorists, to warlords. You know, guns have flooded throughout Africa, and once you get them, they cross borders. And so that was a tricky one because there were groups in the U.S., NRA, who were convinced that if we were trying to stop the spread of guns to these places, that we were also trying to stop the spread of guns in our own country. And we knew that if we got into that, you know, that sort of an argument, then we would not be able to sign this agreement. And in fact, the last administration said, no, it's too hard. You know, we can't bring up we can't work on the ATT. Whereas under the Obama administration, they were able to do it, and we were able to build constituencies with, you know, a lot of different groups, like evangelical groups in the U.S., because, you know, they have missionaries all over the world, and they see what guns are doing. And Oxfam, who is one of the big push for this treaty. And so it was a really great thing. Trade associations, gun trade associations in the U.S., who realize, you know, it's not taking guns from people. But the NRA was trying to make this that the UN is going to come in your house and take your guns away from you. So it was a really big deal that we were able to, and at the last minute, we really didn't know, was the White House ultimately going to be able to go with this or not, given the U.S. domestic constituency. And Secretary Kerry was there the day the treaty was opened up in the UN and signed it for the U.S.
One of the really amazing...
Yeah, it was really good.
That's amazing.
So the way that relates back.
One of the really interesting things about the current moment and the movement in the U.S., and I want to say this really carefully so that everybody has their agency, is that you have this wonderful, amazing group of students that is seizing the moment in a really brave way and driving forward in a way that only they could have done. And they are taking full advantage of and building on an infrastructure that other groups had been slaving away on, I mean, for years on gun reform, often with sort of no visible prospect of success, but continuing to work on it. And among those groups are women-led groups and very explicitly women-organized groups like Moms Demand. And I think if you look at Moms Demand, you see a lot of commonalities with women's peace movements that you see elsewhere in the world, which, and you know, this we've sort of said some things about what we don't think about women's innate capabilities, but there are many, many movements that have built off of women's roles as childbearers, as nurturers, and have used sort of an amazing combination of social norms and shame to promote change on violence and peace issues. And I think the Moms Demand part of the gun movement actually falls very neatly into that.
And that's, I agree with you very much there. When I look back and I, you know, read history in order to learn what might happen in the future, and I look at what happened and why Kennedy was eventually agreed with putting nuclear weapon testing underground. And he's reported to have said it's because of the women. Because women with baby carriages were, you know, circling the White House because they had found strontium-90 in their children's teeth. And that's a radioactive element that is only in the atmosphere because of atmospheric nuclear weapon testing. So Kennedy was said that he was apparently profoundly impacted by women with baby carriages who were parading at the White House. And I think that this infrastructure of protest, this infrastructure of catalyzing change, it is amazing that these students who have been directly impacted are able to seize and to build on that. And I'm so inspired because I know I'm able to do what I do because I stand on the shoulders of the great ones that came before me. And that's what I see these young folks doing as well, standing on the shoulders of those before them.
And on that note, we should thank our panelists for such a lovely conversation. I've learned so much. And thank you all for coming.